The next case of the day is James King against Illinois State Board of Elections, number 033536. Ms. Welch.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The fee-shifting statutes are very simple. The loser pays. And when the plaintiff prevails against a defendant, the defendant has to pay the plaintiff's fees to make the plaintiff whole because the plaintiff's been injured by the defendant's wrongdoing.
Oddly enough, though, the statutes talk about giving fees to the prevailing parties, but at least the statutes themselves, and I want to distinguish that from various Supreme Court cases I know you could cite, don't mention anything about who furnishes that money, whether it's, you know, an intervener, whether it's the defendant, or whether, you know, it's an odd thing about these statutes. It just says the prevailing party shall be allowed a reasonable attorney's fees, or if you look at Rule 54D, it talks about costs being shifted in that way. And we certainly have a number of cases in these types of litigation that aren't your classic binary, you know, A versus B model, where fees get shifted around in interesting ways.
Well, they get shifted around from it being awarded to a defendant from a plaintiff or so on, but they never get shifted from a winner to a winner. The Supreme Court said, I mean, I think the reason that the fee statutes don't say you get it from, the prevailing party gets it from the party prevailed against, because that's just the logical place to look is to the loser.
But, you know, the Illinois State Board of Elections, both in the Hastert litigation and here, for that matter, is in an interesting position because it's been functionally inert both times. And so maybe it was a technical loser once, and maybe it's a technical winner now, but it really doesn't care. You know, you guys have been saying, give us a map, we'll administer it, you know, we're good bureaucrats, and we'll do whatever it is you tell us to do, which is what I understand the position to be. Maybe not a terrible position, but it's hard to call you either a winner or a loser.
Well, no, I mean, it's hard. It isn't really, because in the Hastert litigation, for example, the state is the board is the nominal defendant, because really it's the legislature that was the wrongdoer by not enacting a map, whereas here there's no wrongdoer. I mean, the court found that there was no wrongdoer here. This case actually requires us to think in very fundamental terms about who's a plaintiff and who's a defendant in civil rights cases. A plaintiff in a civil rights case, what Congress wanted was to encourage people to bring civil rights claims to say, I've been injured and I need you, court, to remedy my injury. And when the plaintiff, when the injured party proves that injury, they get to be made whole. This was Congress's intent, by getting the wrongdoer to pay their fees.
But, you know, if this case had been a consolidated case where you had had, let's say, as often happens, you know, a set of white plaintiffs and a set of Hispanic plaintiffs and a set of African-American plaintiffs and so forth, all suing, as you put it, you know, kind of a nominal defendant, the Illinois State Board of Elections, then in the end a map would happen somehow or another. Maybe the court would order it. Maybe it would be done by consent decree. And one set of plaintiffs would probably wind up being happier with that map than another, but it would technically be against the state board. And I take it even in this case, had the King plaintiffs won, and we certainly see from the Supreme Court a number of cases that say racial gerrymandering is not permissible, you would have had to pay fees, right?
Right, because the plaintiffs would have said that the map that the state had implemented by the legislature, like the 2001 map, that the map was unconstitutional or violated the Voting Rights Act. So in that way, the state was the wrongdoer. I mean, the board is the nominal wrongdoer, but again, it would be the state that was the wrongdoer.
But why isn't the best way to think about this case realigning you back to your Hastert posture and just say we have a couple of antagonistic sets of plaintiffs at this point, but in fact your position looks a lot like the position you took in Hastert.
Well, in terms of the neutrality, I mean, that's true. But what happened here, again, what happened here is judgment was entered in our favor. We were not found to be wrongdoers. We, in fact, are winning parties. And that's why we wouldn't get fees against us here. Now, we could, as winning parties, conceptually, and if this were Hastert, we would, even though we were named defendants, we could have gone back to get fees against the plaintiff.
Right,
if
that's
the plaintiff
only on the higher
been,
standard.
Right,
yeah.
If the plaintiff had been frivolous. And that's what, again, you have to go back to, what did Congress intend with the fee-shifting statutes? They had two intents, the Supreme Court has told us, and the legislative history tells us. One is to encourage people to say, I've been injured, and if I can prove I'm injured, I get my fees. And the other intent that the Supreme Court has gleaned is that if a frivolous plaintiff comes along and brings a case and a defendant prevails against that frivolous plaintiff, then in order to discourage frivolous claims and to protect a defendant from frivolous claims, a frivolous claim has to be, the fees have to be paid by the frivolous plaintiff.
Right. No, we understand that. The problem is here that had these interveners not come in, mm-hmm. You would have had an essentially unopposed action by the King. But forget about the Department of Justice. I know they came in later. They came mm-hmm. in 10 days or so after these defendant interveners.
Right.
But when the King plaintiffs file their suit, the state once again says, we don't really care. You know, we're the nominal defendant. Were it not for the efforts of these defendant interveners, I mean, the state was doing nothing.
Your Honor, you can't just say forget the Department of Justice.
There's a free riding aspect to this. You know, what do you do about that?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are two answers to that question. The first answer is that it wasn't free riding because the Department of Justice, which federal law.
Luckily, yeah, no, I know.
Right.
I
mean, Your Honor, what we did.
You're making
kind of
an anti-supremacy clause argument here, actually. You're saying that it is not the responsibility of the state of Illinois in any way to defend the Federal Voting Rights Act.
What I'm saying, Your Honor,
and that seems to me, of course, not to be correct.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that Congress has said that the Department of Justice, that the United States Attorney General is the government entity that is supposed to enforce federal civil rights.
But it doesn't mean the state of Illinois just can say, well, we're just going to sit on our hands. The state of Illinois enforces federal civil rights every day.
Well, Your Honor, let's look at what happened in this case. We filed a motion to dismiss. Our motion to dismiss was denied. Immediately after, within days of our having filed that motion, the United States moved to apply to intervene. Our role, we don't feel that the United States would have been presented an adequate defense. I mean, as a practical matter, there was no need for us to duplicate the United States' efforts here.
Had there been an official notice sent to the U.S. Attorney General?
Your Honor, I don't know that. I don't know. I didn't see it in the record, and I don't know
when to come. Yeah, maybe there was. I don't know.
But again, you have to go back to the function of fees in this case. Now, the Supreme Court has been very clear about this. The logical place to look is to the loser, and you look to the loser because they've either been a wrongdoer if they were the defendant, or they were frivolous if they were the plaintiff. Now, here again, the judgment was entered in favor of of the board and of the interveners and of the United States. There's no wrongdoing. There's no frivolousness. This case is exactly like LULAC. It's the Fifth Circuit case. It's exactly like Campuzano. In Campuzano, the three-judge panel said there is simply no authority at all. And remember, the United States Supreme Court has told us that there has to be explicit statutory authority, not just some roving authority of notions of fundamental equity. There has to be explicit statutory authority for awarding attorney's fees. And there isn't that explicit statutory authority here. As the Campuzano court said, regardless of any difference, the Campuzano court said it would have reached the same conclusion regardless of any factual dissimilarity because there is no authority for ordering a winner to pay another winner's fees. There simply isn't. This kind of award would not, the award to someone who has intervened to oppose a civil rights claim. And let's be clear about this. The plaintiffs here were saying that the map, the existing map, was violating their civil rights. The interveners intervened just like the Campuzano people did to, in order to say, no, this map complies with the law.
Well, but they were also at the same time, that's why it's, you know, difficult to force this, you know, square peg into the round hole of binary litigation. They were saying any other map would violate our civil rights because
they've gone through
this exhausting process of trying to draw a map to create the one Hispanic district without losing, you know, the
right.
three
But, Your Honor, that assumes that there's only one possible lawful district, and that can't be right. I mean, there could be alterations to this map that would, in fact, satisfy everybody's interests that might alter them a little bit. You could still have, and remember also, the 4th District map affects, you know, not just the 1st District, but also the other districts.
Well, exactly, which is why I was not so concerned as you seem to be about the fact that the African-American interveners and the Hispanic interveners remain, because anytime you change so much as a house worth, you know,
right.
and this is done, I guess, all with computers at this point, but I've seen how this redistricting stuff gets done. Everybody's affected by every change, and there are aspects of the zero-sum game to this.
Right, that's true, Your Honor. But again, in Campuzano, they also, you know, they also intervened to defend the Hispanic district. I mean, the same district. I mean, the thing is, their motivation might be different because they got the, you know, they got the Hastert map. But what happened in this case is exactly what happened in Campuzano, is that they were opposing a civil rights claim, and Congress's chosen instrument, you know, for the civil rights claims is people who bring claims saying they're injured, not people who are defending the status quo. However, the status quo has been achieved. It is contrary to Congress's intent to award fees to someone who opposes a civil rights claim, which is what the interveners did in this case. Now, in addition, the district court found, or the three-judge panel here found that this could be considered post-Hastert proceedings. But those cases, the cases that the district court relied on, the cases that the interveners relied on in their briefs, are all about ongoing consent decree proceedings when there's an ongoing consent decree. Here, when the map was approved, the case was over. There was a new start, a new ballgame. This is new law, new plaintiffs. This cannot be considered post-Hastert proceedings. And finally, because there is no enforceable, there's no judgment on the merits for the first district interveners, for the first district, because that case was voluntarily dismissed without prejudice, there can be no finding that the first district interveners were prevailing plaintiffs. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Welch. We'll hear now from Mr. Cummings.
May it please the court, counsel. I think the best way to understand why the three-judge panel's award of fees to the interveners was absolutely correct is to consider the following. Let's go back to 1991. The Hastert case is filed. The Supreme Court decides Shaw versus Reno in 1991, prior to the judgment in Hastert, as opposed to in 1993. The King plaintiffs come in, as the other plaintiff interveners came in, and put a map on the table that does not include a fourth district. The parties go to trial. The three-judge panel in Hastert rules, as it did, that the four-majority-minority congressional district configuration is the one that is necessary to comply with the Voting Rights Act.
But that's where I wanted to come in, because it seems to me that unless one can find the legal justification for taking the very steps that you're describing, in a sense, A, collapsing this litigation back into the Hastert litigation, which may be the right thing to do. Maybe the fact that somebody paid an extra filing fee and the like is a technicality. But collapsing it back into the first and then engaging in a substantial amount of party realignment. Once you finish all that party realignment, the State Board of Elections winds up back on the defendant's side, and it winds up, in a sense, back in something that could be perhaps called the functional equivalent of a loser. You need to do a lot of that before you can get to the point of matching up this award of attorney's fees to the language of the statutes, right? Because otherwise, you know, the state's making a literal argument that you need to meet, which is, you know, they didn't lose this case. And while I'm on the subject, let me just address footnote, I think it's footnote 13 of your brief. You have a footnote in your brief that says, yeah, it's footnote 13 on page 47. You say, the fact that the plaintiffs in this case were advancing their own civil rights doesn't bar the interveners from obtaining a fee award. Plaintiffs would have been entitled to an award of fees had they prevailed, notwithstanding the fact that intervene. Okay. The trouble with that footnote is it sounds to me like no matter who won and who lost, the state has to pay. You know, it's a heads I win, tails you lose. If the plaintiffs had won, the state has to pay. If the defendant interveners prevailed, the state has to pay. What's the scenario where the state doesn't have to pay?
Well, the scenario would have been had the state, with respect to our particular proceeding in King, if the state had come in and it had defended the remedial map that the Hastert Court put in place, it would have rendered the intervener's position and participation in this lawsuit arguably unnecessary.
But you're saying these fee statutes are functionally contribution statutes, then, not fee-shifting statutes in the technical sense.
No, I don't think that's quite what we're saying, Your Honor. And I want to get back to the first question you posed, which is, how does this become collapsed into one proceeding? Well, the reality is that it was on the merits by the King panel. The King panel viewed this case, and I'm quoting, it stated that King's lawsuit is at its very core a challenge to the Hastert Court's order. It's on page 592 of their decision. And because it found that, it evaluated this case under the standards of Rule 60B. It admitted the Hastert Court's factual findings and would hold them conclusive subject to clear error. It treated the conclusions of law of the Hastert Court under the law of the case doctrine subject to conclusiveness absent showing of plain error, and it treated this lawsuit as though it were a continuation of Hastert, and the state did not object to that proceeding. In fact, throughout the merits proceeding, the one consistent argument that the state made is that all this is an attack on Hastert. And everyone, all the parties on the merits of this lawsuit, treated it as though it were a continuation of Hastert. And that's how the case is resolved. And that's really the only way that it made sense to do it, because what was going on here is that the King plaintiffs were challenging the remedy that was put in place by the Hastert Court. The same facts were in question. Everything was aligned.
So how do you get the state, though, to be a loser in this round, if you will, of the litigation when the map that the state has been implementing is the map that winds up continuing to be the lawful map?
Well, let me address that by turning back to a question that you posed earlier during the state's argument regarding the text of the statute. The text of the statute does not specify against whom an award of fee should be assessed. This court made that clear in Charles versus Daly, and it went through an extended analysis on this question, because in that case, the plaintiffs who had prevailed were seeking a fee award against defendant interveners. The defendant intervener said, "You can't get fees against us. We were not found liable to you." This court went through the analysis, and it said that the focus was on determining who is a prevailing party. That's what Congress is focusing on. With respect to who the award should be entered against, you had to look at the equities of the situation and apply the purpose of the fee-shifting statute. The fee-shifting statute's purpose was to encourage private parties to step forward as private attorney generals to advance civil rights. That's exactly what the interveners did in this case, because the state of Illinois failed to step forward to defend the remedy that the Hastert Court ordered. And I would submit that their failure to act in this instance was even worse than before, because you have a court, federal court, telling the state that this map is necessary to protect the civil rights of the African Americans and Latinos in Illinois. The Hastert Court made it clear, and it found the only way to do that, and I would disagree with counsel on this point, the only way to do that was the configuration that was implemented. That's why you have that odd connector going around the 7th Congressional District. That was the only way to do it. And I can tell you, had that not been the case, this map would never have survived the Supreme Court's review, and it did. The Supreme Court stamped approval on that.
I mean, I asked that question, but I, in the course of asking it, I said, forget about what the Supreme Court has said, which, of course, in the final analysis, we can't do. And in Kentucky against Graham and in other cases, the court says this. I mean, one has to understand as a sensible matter that the prevailing party gets fees from the losing party, or at least from somebody, I mean, maybe by extension, someone who isn't another prevailing party.
Well, let me address that point. We want to make it very clear, and I think the parties agree on this. The state was not a prevailing party in the King litigation.
Well, in their, Welsh doesn't think so.
Well,
perhaps in Hastert she would agree.
Well,
with the state.
In their reply brief, they acknowledge that our position is not that interveners aren't entitled to fees because we're prevailing parties, but because we didn't lose. And that's why the focus here in their brief and in their presentation is not so much that they were the prevailing parties, because they were not. Under this court's decision in Hastert, in the context of this kind of redistricting litigation, parties put maps on the table. The party whose map is chosen is prevailing. If your map is not picked, you do not prevail. If you don't put a map on the table, you can't prevail. You can't win, because winning in this context is equivalent to having the map that you are supporting chosen. The state stood on the sidelines, and it did not prevail, notwithstanding the entry of judgment in its favor. And that's why this context is a little bit unique, because ordinarily, if you get a judgment entered in your favor, in most instances, you are considered a prevailing party. But let me go back again to Hastert. All of the plaintiffs in Hastert prevailed. Only some of the plaintiffs in Hastert were considered, or all of them had a judgment entered in their favor. Let me be clear. Only some of them were considered prevailing parties.
But
it was not enough.
Going back to what you said before, when I was talking about the fact that it sounded to me like no matter who won or lost in this particular case, the state was going to be stuck with the attorney's fees. You said, yeah, but they wouldn't have if they had exerted the effort to defend the map. That does take me to the Department of Justice's position. I realize, you know, I don't question that the lawyers for the interveners did a lot of work, but the Department of Justice comes into the case literally 10 days after you did.
Well, Your Honor, that is a little bit misleading the way that was phrased. Let me sketch out the timeline for you.
Well, I mean,
this case was filed in February of 1995.
I'm familiar. Do you disagree that on September 20th your motion is granted, and they moved to intervene on September 29th, and I guess the motion's granted in November?
Yes, it was granted in November, but the trial, Your Honor, was in the middle of December. It's about a month later. And between September, when we came in, and when the Department of Justice was granted leave to come in, they applied 10 days after us, but they were not granted leave until November. We filed an answer to the complaint on the merits and took a substantive position, which the state did not do. We did all the pretrial discovery, which the Department of Justice was not in a position to do because it wasn't in the case. We helped retain and prepare the experts and refine the expert analyses with them and work on their reports. We contributed to the pretrial brief and to the post-trial findings of fact and conclusions of law. So in this compressed time frame, they came in at what was the equivalent, they were allowed to come in at what was the equivalent of the 11th hour, and we did a tremendous amount of work between the time we came into the case and roughly seven weeks later when they were allowed in. And that's why the three-judge panel recognized that the interveners carried the weight of the defense, and quite frankly, that's why in the district court proceedings, they did not dispute the court's finding. They come up here now and try to suggest that really the Department of Justice did everything, but that's not the reality that was found by the district court, that's reflected in our time records, and that was the only thing that really could have happened given how the timeline worked out here. So this is not the typical situation where the United States is in the case first, and then the private interveners come in after the United States is in. This is the reverse, and in the Donnell case, the D.C. Circuit recognized that it is particularly appropriate for defendant interveners to receive fees when they are the initial parties in the case and the government comes in later. And that's a circumstance we have here, and that's why the court made the finding that it did. And that finding is clearly correct.
What about the fact that the state did, in fact, file the initial motion? I believe it was on Lashes, and there were two grounds in the motion to dismiss the King case as soon as it was instituted.
Well, that motion did not go to the merits. It did not go to the merits of the case.
People often will file initial. They'll do it on statute of limitations. They'll do it on all sorts of grounds. And if it gets rid of the case, it gets rid of the case, right?
Well, but the fact of the reality is it didn't get rid of the case.
No, it didn't.
And that's all that they did. And so far as their participation at trial, it was going toward developing those two defenses, the standing defense and the laches defense, which when you look at the three-judge panel's ruling on the motion to dismiss, there was no way that was going to change. But that's all they did at the trial. They never took a position on the merits, and to this day, they've never strayed away from their position as a neutral party. And the reason that the equity requires the state to bear this award is that, as the court held, their inaction was a continuation of what led to the first Hastert litigation. Inaction in the face of a duty to act. In the first instance, it was a duty to put a proper map in place. In the second instance, as you pointed out, Your Honor, it was a duty to defend a judgment that was inputted to remedy a violation of the Voting Rights Act. You can't stand back and let that be challenged. And had we not come in, given the timing of everything, that map may have been swept away and the voting rights of the African Americans and Latinos in this state would have been swept away as well. We had to act. We went to them first. We didn't just come in. We went to them first and said, look, please defend this. And if you're not going to defend this, retain us. We'll do it for you. They said, no, we're going to be neutral. We're not going to retain you. We're not going to do anything. And so we had to act, come in as the private attorney generals to do their job. And that's what Congress intended these fee-shifting statutes to reward. We were acting as traditional civil rights plaintiffs, defending a remedial map that was put in place after careful findings by the Hastert Court. And that's what sets us apart from the plaintiffs in Campuzano and in the LULAC case, where there was a map put in place. There were no prior findings of any sort of violation. And the interveners came in and said, well, this map complies with the law, or this scheme complies with the law.
So you're in effect arguing, I think, that you were, from a certain point of view, in an adversary position vis-a-vis the state. The state thought it could sit on its hands, and you thought, no, you have to do something.
Well, yes, insofar as that goes, sure. And when they didn't do anything, we weren't concerned about them. We went in and took care of our business and made sure that this map stayed in place. That's all we had. That's the only option that we had. And to not award fees in that scenario would be inequitable. Thank you. And if there are no further questions, take my seat.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. You have 2 minutes, Ms. Welsh.
What the intervener's argument seems to be is that, and what he started out saying was that if the state had actively defended, the interveners wouldn't have had to come in. That's their argument. That's a quantum merit argument. That is not an argument that falls within the fee-shifting statutes. And remember, the Supreme Court said you have to have explicit statutory authority. There is not roving authority in the district courts to give fee awards whenever they think.
Do you dispute his characterization of the situation? Were you asked to take a stance defending the legitimacy of the map and communicated to the defendant interveners that you would take a neutral position before the court?
Yes, Your Honor, we did. And the thing, but you have to remember here that they didn't have to step in again. Within days, the United States intervened, and the courts.
Didn't intervene. They moved.
But they moved to intervene.
Actually 2 months. Before
I'm sorry.
They intervened.
That's true. But the court said, "Go on with discovery as though the United States is a party." That was the immediate response of the court.
But who was doing it? Were there assistant U.S. attorneys at the depositions? Were they noticing how could they without intervention?
Your Honor, they were because the court had said that it was allowing the United States to participate in discovery as though it was a party. So the United States was.
I want to know who was there. I mean, the record should reflect somehow. The record should show whether the U.S. attorneys the AUSAs were doing anything.
I don't, Your Honor, I don't think the record does because there
aren't. Or the Civil Rights Division people,
but,
I don't know. Who?
But, Your Honor, I mean, the fact is.
Who lined up the expert witnesses to testify in favor of the map?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Who lined up the expert witnesses?
Well, certainly I know that the United States was the one that questioned all of them, so I would assume that they certainly had a role in doing that. But again, in Alliance to End Repression, this court refused to award fees in a similar case where the original plaintiff said, we had to come in to defend our, may I finish my thought?
Sure.
We had to come in to defend the consent decree that we won. And this court said, no, you don't. There is not an ongoing duty to defend. You are, in effect, a volunteer, and you don't get a lifetime of fees after you get an award. In closing, I ask that this court reverse the fee award here because the board was not a losing party. The interveners did not prevail against them. And in particular, to reverse the award against the first district interveners because they were not prevailing parties. Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel for their fine presentations. And the case will be taken under advisement.